You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 191 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled Understanding Society Through Spiritual Scientific Knowledge, 15 Lectures, translated by Matthew Barton. This is Lecture 10, given in Dornach on the 23rd of October, 1919. We have spoken from various angles about the relationship between a spiritual scientific worldview and a social outlook. We are discussing these themes because it is so necessary to recognize today that thorough healing of our life and really fruitful developments toward the future are only possible if spiritual scientific ideas enter human thinking and modes of thought. Apart from what I said recently, in relation to a retrospective view of our biography, something else can be said about it too. I pointed out that when we look back on our life so far, we must also be aware that in the ordinary mind, we perceive it only discontinuously, and that states of sleep intervene between these discontinuous parts. These states of sleep are not really included in our review, and we easily succumb to a certain illusion in regard to this. We believe that our life is a continuous thread, but it is not. This life of ours shows us only interrupted episodes. But if we draw on spiritual scientific foundations, we ought to realize that periods unseen in our retrospective review are nevertheless just as much experience as the experiences incorporated into our ordinary mind and memory. Now, the experiences which the human soul always undergoes during sleep are not easy to describe. And this is because we must liberate ourselves from various things belonging to our ordinary outlook and awareness if we are to form any concept at all of what occurs for us in the periods between falling asleep and awakening again. In ordinary life, we live in space and time. When fully asleep, seen now from the perspective of ordinary consciousness, it is true to say that we are living neither in ordinary time nor ordinary space. When we recall what happens to us during sleep, this memory is a kind of shadow image, or we can say a projection, of what has been experienced in sleep into the space-time conditions of waking life. But if you wish to study these conditions more precisely, you will have to consider also that the state of sleep is not simply one of rest in contrast to the waking state. In this respect, particularly, we are at risk of succumbing to a mistaken judgment based more on preconceptions than on actual seeing. If we regard ordinary waking life as our normal, in quotes, state, we can ask when our sleeping state occurred. This rest is only present really at two points, the moment of falling asleep and the moment of awakening. Falling asleep and awakening are, in a sense, zero points compared to waking consciousness. The state of sleep itself is not a zero point, but the opposite. Let's take a metaphor for this from mathematics. You can have a sum of money, let us say 50 francs. You have this sum. When you have spent it all, you have nothing. But when you have accrued debts to the tune of 50 francs, you have less than nothing, a negative sum. The zero point relative to waking life is the moment of falling asleep, and that of reawakening. But the state of sleep itself is a negative condition relative to the ordinary waking state. While we sleep, processes occur that are the reverse of ones occurring in waking life, processes of a very different kind, ones whose reality is not subject to the laws of space and time, like those of waking consciousness. But something really comes into its own element in this state of sleep, as you may have sensed in a recent lecture, our true I, capital. The I lives in our will, but is asleep there, as we know. The true I does not enter our ordinary life of thoughts. We would never become aware of it except as a kind of negative space. And as we look back on our life and experiences, we do not include both days and nights in our review, but only the waking experiences of our days. And instead of saying that we look back on our nights, we say I. We feel ourselves to be an I. Such truths must slowly permeate human beings, for otherwise they will be crushed by a merely scientific view of the world, which has, of course, also, for the majority of people today, come to encompass all other realms of life, all other outlooks. We will only come to know ourselves fully if we can say to ourselves at every moment of our life that we are not only a person of flesh and blood, with consciousness, as most people today are aware of, but also someone who hatches or emerges from his body between falling asleep and reawakening. And that during this time of sleep, we live in quite different conditions than in ordinary waking life. Only then, during sleep, is our I in its own true element. It can unfold and lay claim to its substantiality. During waking life, our I is only present in the will. In thinking, and even in a large part of our feeling, we only possess images of this I. This is why it is badly mistaken for some philosophers to claim that there is reality in the I a person addresses as his. Only if we woke to higher consciousness in sleep would we perceive the true I. Or if we could see the process at work in the will, then, too, we could experience our true I in this will. These things should really pass into our feelings and sensibility if they are to play their due part in life. We must be able to recognize that in our ordinary outlook on the world, we are only able to comprehend one half of our being, and that in the other half we are perpetually embedded in supersensible experiences, which we are unable to perceive with our ordinary consciousness. A person will only be able to acquire a certain reverence for underlying creative principles at work in us if he can connect with supersensible reality in this way. And in a materialistic age such as ours, not only will a view of the supersensible realm disappear, but along with it also this reverence for the creative principles at work in the world. Reverence altogether will vanish from human hearts. There is really very little reverence today. Very few of the feelings that can truly lift our sensibility to the supersensible realm. Many of the feelings people still try to preserve are nothing more than a kind of sentimentality, which is always also untrue. Sentimentality is never entirely true. If we become conscious of such things, and once again I am obliged to mention this, by absorbing them into both our mind and feelings, a fact dawns before our mind's eye, EYE, that human life and the life of the world possess something like the character of a great mystery. And without this view, that life and the cosmic order are a mystery, real progress in humanity's evolution is unthinkable. an age like ours, in which no one wishes any longer to believe that life conceals secrets, can basically be only a passing episode. Such eras can exist in order that people cut themselves off for a while from their true depths, so that subsequently, through a counter-reaction to this withdrawal, they delve all the further into a real sense for the mystery of life. But this mystery of life can come home to us neither through sentimentality nor abstraction. It can only dawn on us if we are inclined to enter into the realities of the supersensible world in specific detail. We can make something like a beginning with this if we can really develop a kind of sacred feeling toward our entry into the state of sleep, and likewise a sacred feeling as we look back upon it, that condition when we were, without even really speaking metaphorically, dwelling in the habitations of the gods. But ultimately, we must recognize how far removed modern outlooks are from this, and how thoughtlessly humanity today regards this other side of life. But if the realm that lies behind falling asleep and awaking is not understood, how can anyone encompass what lies beyond the span between birth and death? Beyond this span of our earthly life lives something that also exists between birth and death, although here it is hidden behind a corporeal sheath. If there were a less egoistic religiosity, a more altruistic religiosity alive today, I have spoken of this before, the experiences we pass through from birth onward would be seen as a continuation of pre-birth or preconception existence in the world of spirit. And then we would see occurrences in human life as miracles, as enigmas we must continually seek to decipher. We would feel a longing to look upon human development as a revelation of something that takes shape, configures, and embodies itself from supersensible worlds into the sense world. And basically, it is already true to say that we can only comprehend post-mortem existence in the right way if we first consider life before birth. Life is indeed full of mysteries, and in our era, evolutionary necessities mean that a number of them must be revealed to humanity. We cannot acquire awareness of the entirety of our being and nature if we do not enlarge our view of ourselves to encompass life both before birth and after death. Without allowing our pre-birth and after-death life to shine into this corporeal existence, we will know only a part of our being. It is still extraordinarily difficult to talk to people about these things, unless they are previously prepared, somewhat, through a study of anthroposophy. Either they are keenly interested in preventing the truth of such things from reaching others, or they simply fail to understand them. You need only look around you to discover that most people, in their habituated views of the world, pay very little attention indeed to pre-birth life. They are more concerned with life after death, because they would much prefer to survive the decay of their physical body. Religious confessions reckon with this kind of egoism, speaking basically only of life after death, but not of life before birth. Now, this isn't the whole picture, but it is still hard to talk about these things today, since it is a dogma of the Catholic Church not to believe in a life before birth, and other religious confessions have adopted this too. Most of the Christian confessions now consider it heresy to speak of pre-birth life. But to dogmatically refuse to consider life before birth has an extraordinary impact on humanity's evolution. I am not so much speaking of conscious things, but more unconscious factors in human evolution. But there is almost nothing conceivably more likely to cradle people in illusions about their own nature than to withhold from them insights into life before birth. This is because it falsifies our whole outlook on life. If we are deceived into thinking our presence here on earth is due only to mother and father. In creating this illusion, the Church has secured itself a hugely powerful means to withhold insight into pre-birth existence. And the Church will therefore fight ferociously against all teachings concerning it. The Church will not endure them. One should not succumb to any illusions on this point, nor should one think that life is easy to understand without taking account of pre-birth existence. But there is something resulting from this to which you should give deep and thorough heed. Let us recognize that it lay in the interests of ecclesiastical confessions to withhold important truths about human nature from people, that they more or less made it into their mission to do so. By this means, the churches were able to wrap people in dullness and illusion. And now, today, we must no longer be deceived about this, nor seek a tactful compromise here with all kinds of ecclesiastical confession. No compromise should be made. And let us be clear that it will serve no purpose to try to say that anthroposophy is concerned with the Christ, is not atheistic nor pantheistic, and so on. This will never help, since the Church confessions will not mind in the least if you do not concern yourself with Christ. They wish to hold a monopoly on speaking about Christ, and they will simply be irritated that you concern yourself with Christ. They want to hold a monopoly on the subject, and there is no point in your forbearance, for if you accommodate them, you will always be inclined to conceal the most important aspects of life in fog and obscurity. Humanity at present needs to work its way through to spiritual insights, to which the dogmatic Church confessions are most of all opposed, especially those confessions that have gradually developed here in the West. The Church, as such, cannot be at odds with spiritual scientific insights. That is impossible, for intrinsically the Church ought to be concerned only with human feeling, with ceremonies and acts of worship, but not with a life of thoughts. An educated Oriental completely fails to comprehend Western ecclesiastical confessions, since he well knows he is bound to the outward rite, giving himself up to ceremonies customary in his faith, but may think whatever he likes. In Oriental faith there is still some regard for freedom of thought, a freedom that the Europeans have entirely lost. They have been raised to subservience in their thinking, especially since the 8th or 9th century A.D., and this is why people in the West find it so difficult to grapple with things I recently said, that it is easy to prove any point of view, that one can prove one thing and equally well its opposite. And the fact that something can be proven is no evidence of the truth of what is asserted. To arrive at the truth, you have to delve into far deeper strata of experience than those in which our ordinary proofs lie. But such experience is not something the Church confessions wished to bring to the surface. And so they have sundered people from truths such as this: O man, you stand here, and as your organism develops from infancy, gradually there develops in you what you underwent in your life before birth. And what is it that chiefly develops out of pre-birth existence in an individual life, between birth and death? Well, we can distinguish between a person's individual life and social interactions. Without keeping these two poles of human experience apart, you cannot actually form any idea of the human being at all. Individual life, what we possess at every moment as our most intrinsically private experience, and social life, what we could not have if we did not continually enter into an exchange of thoughts and into other kinds of interaction with people. Individual and social factors play into human life. Everything that is individual in us is basically the reverberation of pre-birth life, while everything we develop in the social realm is the germ of life after death. Recently, we even noted that it is the germ of karma, and so we can say that we contain both individual and social aspects in ourselves. What is individual is the echo of pre-birth existence, and what is social is the germ of post-mortem existence. The first part of this truth, that the individual element is in a sense the echo of pre-birth life, is something we can see particularly well if we study those with special gifts. Let's go to the radical extreme, which is a good idea here, and consider the phenomenon of genius. Where does the power of genius originate? Genius is an unusual capacity of some kind that a person brings with them at birth. It is always the outcome of life before birth. And since, understandably, pre-birth life comes to expression in childhood especially, for later a person adapts more to the life between birth and death, whereas in childhood, everything he experienced prior to birth emerges. The childlike quality is expressed throughout a genius's life. We can say that a genius is distinguished by his ability to preserve something childlike throughout life. The genius maintains his youthfulness, his childlike quality, into advanced old age, because genius itself is connected with pre-birth existence. But not just genius. All gifts, everything that makes someone an individual, are connected with pre-birth existence. If one, therefore, insists on the dogma that there is no such thing, no pre-existence, what does this imply? It is a way of spreading the doctrine that no foundation exists for special individual gifts. You know that, if they are entirely honest, ecclesiastical confessions hold that there are no grounds for personal gifts. One can't actually dispute that these gifts exist, but what underlies and sustains them is denied, and so they can be regarded as fairly unimportant. And this is connected, in turn, with the fact that church confessions, reigning for centuries, have brought about an education in Europe that ultimately led to human uniformity today, to the leveling of people. How do people today regard individual gifts and talents? And what would they be if socialist teachings were made reality? In such matters, it is less important to take outward names at face value than to consider inner connections. Someone who is both a Catholic, who believes in the dogmas of his faith, and at the same time hates the teachings of the Social Democrats, lives in a very curious dichotomy. It is like saying that you met a little boy in 1875 of whom you grew very fond, and still like him a great deal today. And if someone objects that the little boy of 1875 has, of course, become a man by now, and stands before you as a Social Democrat, no longer the little boy he was, it is as if you were to reply that, yes, you are still fond of the little boy from back then with the life he had at that time, but you don't at all like what he has become. Social democracy grew from Catholicism. Catholicism is merely the little boy who grew up to be social democracy. Neither the former nor the latter wish to acknowledge this is so, simply because people do not wish to discern a living dynamic in the social realm, but see in it instead just something like papier-mâché, something stiff and rigid that retains its form for as long as it does. In fact, what lives in society grows and lives, and it can also be preserved. But then one must distinguish between illusion and reality. Look, you distinguish between illusion and reality if you recognize the following. Catholicism in the 8th century grew to be the social democracy of the 20th. And what survives as Catholicism alongside it is not true Catholicism of the 8th century, but an imitation of it. Is a Catholicism copied from it, since true Catholicism has, in the meanwhile, grown to be social democracy. In general, this is not acknowledged, since people do not wish to take the trouble to see realities, preferring instead to set up illusions, deceptions, in front of reality. And that is easily done. You simply give something that has long gone the same name as it once had. But if, to put this in a nutshell, you give the name Catholicism to what is represented in Rome and disseminated through Europe, give it the same name as applied to what Rome embodied in the 8th century, it is like calling a 60-year-old man a boy of 8. The boy was once 8, but he no longer is now. I am drawing your attention here to something we need to consider, since the social realm can be regarded as something living and not dead. And unless we comprehend these things, humanity today will not succeed in gaining insight into the nature of truly social existence. Society's roots lie in spheres into which we usually no longer delve with our externalized nomenclatures, in whatever language. We have most chance of doing so in Oriental languages, little enough in European languages, and least of all in English or American English, which is far removed from reality. In other words, our languages are obstacles to understanding the social realm, and humanity will only develop insight into society by emancipating itself from merely linguistic understanding. But nowadays people abhor everything that goes beyond mere linguistic comprehension. And what one most often finds is that when anyone tries to explain something to you, they first offer you some verbal explanation. And yet it does not matter at all how you call or name something, what words you use to describe it. What is important instead is to lead people to reality, not to words. Above all, therefore, if we wish to develop social understanding, we must overcome our entanglement in language. And this can happen only if we also overcome the greatest prejudices of our time. In the terrible war years we have recently experienced, we heard the call of, quote, freedom for every nation, close quote, resounding through the world. The smallest nations today seek to establish their own social structures. A passion and paroxysm of nationalism has come over mankind. And this is as injurious for society on earth as materialism is for our life of thought. And just as we must work our way beyond materialism toward freedom and spirituality, so human beings must work their way beyond nationalism, in whatever form it manifests, toward a universal humanity. Unless we do, we will not make progress. We will, however, not find it possible to emerge entirely from nationalism if our languages do not approximate themselves to deeper forms of expression for the spirit. I'd like to close these reflections, more or less, with a picture, and if you ponder on it a little, you can arrive at various things of importance for understanding the modern age. Look at any book today, and you see these little devils, printed words, as black words on white paper. They have grotesque forms, and in their juxtaposition they signify the sounds of speech. They can be traced back to other, more expressive forms of writing and script. If we go back a long way, we come to forms of writing such as the Egyptians possessed, or ancient Sanskrit, which more or less originated entirely from snake-like forms. Sanskrit symbols are transformed snake shapes, with all sorts of additions. The Egyptian hieroglyphs were still painted or drawn images, picture script, and in their most ancient period were even an imagination of what was portrayed or embodied. Script derived directly from the spirit. Then it grew ever more abstract, until it became something that was already bad enough, our own ordinary script, connected with what it signifies only by virtue of our learning its forms. Then came something still more dire, stenography, which is now the complete death of this whole system that developed out of the old picture script. The declining line of development must give way in turn to an ascending one. We have to return to a trajectory that leads us back from everything that script, especially, drew us down into. And the beginning of an attempt to do so has been made in the form of what stands here on the Dornoch Hill. Though this building leaves much to be desired, much of it is imperfect, its forms express in a contemporary way the supersensible being toward whom we human beings should look. It is also, I would say, intended as a world hieroglyph. If you really study its various forms, you will be able to read in them far more than you can absorb through descriptions of the spiritual realm, or at least that is the intention. The intention is to realize a cosmic script in this building. Script emerged from art originally, and it must return to art. And it must move beyond symbolism to allow the spirit to live directly within it, by becoming again a new kind of hieroglyph. The building that stands here will only be rightly understood if we recognize that there are various demands upon humanity today that require an answer. Basically, the words of language are no longer by any means sufficient to give this reply. Such an answer has been attempted with the forms of this building. Much in it is imperfect, but this building has been an attempt to give an answer. And if one looks at it in this light, it will be the right way to look at it. This is what I wish to add to our previous reflections. The end of Lecture 10.